the Northwest, the legend of Bigfoot dates back hundreds of years.
This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange.
He became the first cabinet-level politician from a G8 country to publicly state that there is extraterrestrial life present on Earth.
Strange Harbor, online at strangeharbor.net.
They say everything that we know, everything that we are, everything that we have comes from the people living on Nibiru.
Strange Harbor, be strange.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We talk about ghosts, UFOs, Sasquatch, conspiracies, near-death experience, all sorts of fun subjects. I am Johnny Manson, and she is MUFON investigator Cherie DeSeuss.
Keeping it real with UFOs.
And speaking of MUFON, our guest today is California's Assistant Director, Chief Investigator Earl Gray Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Johnny. I'm proud to be a guest with you guys.
We're so glad to have you here.
She's so excited. I could tell. I'm getting the excited vibe from Cherie. She's beaming.
Yeah. I mean, you are the poster child for MUFON. You've had experiences. You know people that are close to you that have had experiences. You understand with over 400 cases that you've closed for MUFON.
We're at 500 now, Cherie.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
I have to update my resume, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, people keep flooding in all with their experiences and their sightings. So tell me, where are we at now in the field of UFOs?
It's kind of, the floodgates have opened up over the last 3 years or so. You know, I think that the Nimitz/Princeton case that made the New York Times front page back in 2017 kind of changed the scenario, and it seems to be a little bit more openness as far as governmental agencies, military goes, as far as at least they're willing to talk about the phenomenon now. They're not using they don't laugh at you anymore. I mean, time was that the way that they dealt with the phenomenon, it was the Robertson panel that they convened back in 1952,
right,
where there was concern because people were seeing flying saucers. They had 2 days in a row where there was an overflight over the White House. And they decided that the best way to deal with it was to make fun of those that reported seeing UFOs. It was a ridicule factor that's been there since at least 1952. And it seems like that idea had its day and is finally sort of slipping away. And people in the government, whether Harry Reid or, there's so many people that are coming out and saying that this is a real thing. It's considered a national security issue. I think that they've always taken it seriously, Cherie, but I think that now they have a bit more ease in talking about it in public.
Do you believe that the U.S. government will disclose an alien alliance or that UFOs are real within 180 days, like they've stated?
I don't think so. I don't think that we're going to get much more than the usual crumbs that we get, because there's no real reason for them to do that. Of course, whatever they share with the public, they're sharing with, we're sharing with China and Russia and other countries that may not be so friendly, or have such good agendas towards us. So I think that they're going to be careful about what they give us, but just the fact that they're giving us anything now is definitely a paradigm change.
Well, Nick Pope yesterday twittered that the United States government just released a huge base of documents about UFOs that absolutely anybody can get into. This was yesterday. Had you heard that yet?
Yeah, I guess John Greenwald from the Black Vault got the lion's share of those. They're up on his website, is what I was reading. I haven't had a chance to really go and peruse exactly what was released yet. But, yeah, I mean, it's a definitely a change of attitude, because just 10 years ago, you'd be laughed out of town. They were still using ridicule as a means of dealing with a phenomenon in public.
Well,
so the fact that they're willing to release stuff and talk about it now, I don't think we're going to get full disclosure. I think that literally there's too many bodies buried around the issue. There is a new openness.
President Trump signed a decree that there should and will be disclosure in 180 days. I believe that's sentence cement. So we should be seeing, even if it's placating people who believe in UFOs, there should be something.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's about time, don't you think? I mean, people are so interested in the subject. You know, I'm actually working as a mentor with a local college here that they're actually offering a class in ufology and the history behind UFO sightings and the philosophies that have risen up around the phenomenon. And this is the sort of thing that wouldn't have happened. There wouldn't have been funding for it. It would have, the Robertson panel's way of dealing with UFOs with ridicule, it worked really well for the government, I think, up until recently.
Professor Hynek and the Blue Book that's so famous, and then on top of that, the Robertson panel that made decisions about UFOs, and then there was the, what was it, the 12? The
MJ-12 group.
The majestic MJ-12 group that, you know, we've had a central government or loosely government agencies forever that made decisions on whether ordinary folk get any information at all about UFOs. Now we're getting past that. We're finally getting past that. And, you know, too many people are having experiences. I saw that one out of five people have an experience, have seen a UFO. That's huge. That's 20% of the human race that have had some kind of experience with the paranormal of some kind.
You know, it's like Stanton Friedman when he used to give his talks back when he started in the field. He would ask the audience, well, how many of you have seen a UFO yourself? And half the audience would be raising their hands. And then he would say, how many of you actually reported that to an agency? And all the hands come down, you know? So
yeah.
People see me. But again, you know, I mean, usually, I mean, I'll hear from people. I'll talk with somebody about a sighting they had, say, 20, 30 years ago. And I'll say, well, what kept you until now, as far as reporting it, you kept this to yourself? And again, it would be, well, I don't want people to think I'm crazy.
Stigma.
The ridicule factor again.
Sure,
you know?
The stigma. Well, I've heard you say that you have family history of UFOs or experiences. How is that?
Always seems to come back down to my mom. My mom's name was Betty Grace Maiden. She had an experience when she was a little girl growing up in Iowa. She used to call it her ball lightning experience, but it doesn't sound like ball lightning. It sounds to me like it was under intelligent control. And when you speak with experiencers, you speak with people that have, you know, that have seen a UFO or have had a visit from entities, there usually is a family history. It's very seldom will you have one person who sees a UFO and it's never happened before in the family. So I think that, you know, I don't think that UFO sightings or experiences are random. I think that, you know, it's kind of an interactive phenomenon and it has a purpose behind itself. But my mom told a story about when she was a little girl and they would sleep on their screened-in porch in Muscatine, Iowa, she and her sister. And it was after midnight, I believe, where my mom, she heard this buzzing sound. And she and her sister had little bedrolls set up. And my mom got up. She said that she pushed herself up on her elbows. And she saw it was like a beach ball-sized ball of sparks, it was a ball of electricity. It was making this buzzing sound like an angry hive of hornets is how she described it. And this thing pushed through the screen. It's like cheese through a grater, but yet maintained its shape. And she said that it was like standing next to, if somebody had a shot off a firework. I mean, that was how bright it was, except it was right up next to her.
Sure.
She watched this thing hover around in their patio area. It hovered over her sister, and that was my aunt Mary, and she was asleep. And she slept through the whole thing. But the ball of sparks hung over her, and then it came over to where my mom was, and it was right in front of her face. She said that it was maybe 2 feet away, and it just hovered there. My mom was just entranced by it. It was almost like she had made eye contact with it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it went back to the screen and pushed its way back out the way that it pushed its way in. And it started slowly moving across their front yard, you know, which was adjacent to their neighbor's cornfield. So my mom said that she got up and she actually started running after this ball of sparks, and it went out to the middle of this cornfield. It was about 30 feet in the air when my mom caught up with it. And again, she was standing under it, looking up, and this thing was hovering, you know, 30, 40 feet above her. And she said suddenly it popped, like you'd pop a soap bubble. And she said it smelled like electric train, is the way that she described it, which
sure.
is ozone, some kind of an electrical phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
Now, ball lightning lasts like 3 to 5 seconds. 10 seconds max is what I've heard. You know, I've had many conversations with my friend, Dr. Irina Scott.
Right.
Who wrote a book called Inside the Lightning Ball. And then she had an experience with ball lightning. But she felt like what my mom saw was not ball lightning. It lasted too long. It seemed to be under intelligent control. And, so that's the very first phenomena that my mom talked about when I was a kid. I started hearing this story when I was 5 years old. My mom seemed to feel free to talk about this. She never mentioned this in context of UFOs, by the way, or alien lives. But, you know, I think that she purposefully didn't talk about the subjects at the same time. But the story that she told me was, and it would have been around 1955, 56, was that they flew her out with a security detail out to the Great American Desert. She didn't say which Great American Desert, so I don't know if it was, you know, Area 51 or White Sands in New Mexico. She wouldn't say that. But she said that she and the security detail went to this little shack that looked like a pump house,
mm-hmm.
middle of nowhere. She said it was the only thing out there other than rocks and sand and intense sunlight. So they went in this shack, and there was an elevator. It was an Otis elevator like you'd see in a skyscraper, but, of course, it only went one direction.
Right.
It went down. And of course, it would go up, I guess, you know, when people would leave. So anyhow, she didn't know what to expect. They didn't really give her any idea of what she was going to be part of or see. So she got in there. She thought that it would probably go down a floor or two, and it kept on going down. She said that she felt butterflies in her stomach.
I bet.
Now, when the screen reached its final destination, it took a while to get there. The doors opened up, and she said that there was a little city under the desert floor. She said that people got around in golf carts, that they had cafes, they had movie theaters. They had a bowling alley. She said that she had somebody that could do her hair for her when she went on site. and she even mentioned I'll always remember this. She talked about that they had a little cafe that had tables with yellow umbrellas, and it tickled her funny bone because, you know, she said, quote unquote, she said, well, you don't need an umbrella in a cave.
Well, it's good for effect, though, huh?
You see, yeah. I mean, they were trying to make people feel comfortable. The other thing my mom used to talk about, this sort of the floodgates opened up after I took her to see the movie Star Wars back in 1977. And the lights in the theater were going up, and my mom became voluble. She started talking about, she said, well, Earl, you have no idea how close to the truth this movie is. The spaceships, the different races, said that this is a very real thing. And my mom was, I mean, this, she was very, very serious. I mean, the movie just really, it had moved her emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one time where she really gave me some detail. And at the time, I didn't want to hear this. It went against my own philosophy. I'd become kind of a born-again Christian type. And you know, it was a scary idea that we weren't alone at that point.
Huh, okay.
But she said that it was a very, very real thing. She said it's realer than you will ever know. Now, my mom started working, and she started working again. She worked as a headhunter for aerospace companies. She worked for Lockheed, Northrop, Raytheon. She worked, you know, she peopled the Rockwell Science Center over here in Thousand Oaks, California. So she stopped talking about it. You know, the last big conversation I got was after Star Wars. And this is what led me to eventually join MUFON. I wanted to know more. I wanted it to, and boy, I found out more, you know. I mean, I'll tell you that the phenomena is, it becomes personal.
Right.
We don't get to, you know, be scientists on the outside looking through a microscope at this thing like it were a slide. And what I've really found is that UFOs are large objects that behave like the smallest objects in existence. They can change form, they can appear to evade the laws of physics in the same way that a subatomic particle can take on the characteristics of a wave.
Right, that, like gravity waves.
So they're very, very large things that act like small things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you poke at the universe, you can't be surprised if it pokes back. It's the other thing I've found. Now, I've spoken with, now, as you, I'm sure you know, when we're working as field investigators, that's where we're trying to, you know, poke holes in people's stories, and we, you know, we use a scientific method. You know, Occam's razor is, you know, we shave with that every morning, you know, when we're doing our job right, anyhow. You know, it's the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of you know, humanity is MUFON's credo.
Right.
But when we work with the ERT, the Experiencer Research Team, this is different. I mean, it's I think that we're sort of like social workers for those who have had alien contact. Now, I've had an experience myself. My wife and I, when I joined MUFON, I thought that I was, again, you know, I was very nuts and bolts about the subject, and I thought that I was going to be this researcher somehow on the outside, but I'm finding that a lot of people that go into the field and that, you know, haven't had their own experience, that when they start researching it, and especially when you research hands-on, that it seems to open up a window and the phenomenon comes in and it becomes nobody is separate from the phenomenon. When if you start looking into it, it will reveal itself to you, but it's not just going to be, you know, with numbers and abstracts. It becomes personal. Now, the first case that I had that was an experiencer case, it was actually the first case that I gave an unknown a disposition to after studying this case and speaking with a man involved and family members. Back in the early 1990s, and I won't mention names and stuff, he was taking his newborn child along with his family to the Bakersfield area. They had a month-old baby, and they were driving through the desert. They were out there near China Lake area, and it was in the early evening, and he needed to go and use nature's bathroom because there wasn't really anything else available, you know.
Yeah.
So they stopped the car. He got out and he was, you know, doing his business there when he looks up and he sees the stars seemed just unusually bright. So he called he asked his wife, he said, come on, look at this. You know, and so they're both standing there looking at the stars when he notices a shift, that they started moving towards a concentric point. He's watching this, his mouth agape, and he watched the stars sort of go in a circle overhead, and he, of course, realizes that they weren't stars. He turned around to find his wife, and she wasn't there. And then he hears her voice behind the car, is sort of in the middle of the street there, and she said, "Don't worry, they're not going to harm us."
Yeah.
He said that it was his wife speaking, but it was not her speaking. So he watched these stars started falling towards the desert floor, almost like a circular curtain around him and his wife. The station wagon is parked there with the kids in there, three children. One is a newborn, month-old baby. Anyhow, he watched these lights come down. They became brighter as they got closer, and they hit the desert floor and started racing towards them. They were like in the center of the circle. He's trying to, I mean, this all happened within like a minute, 2 minutes max. He's trying to make some sense of what's going on when he said that he saw this red light that was playing in the weeds that were, maybe a couple yards away from him at his feet. And he said it was just like this ball of red light. And he said it was moving around there. And he said in retrospect that he felt that it was almost like the way that you'd play with a cat with a laser pointer. It was to divert his attention to something that wasn't as important. But again, here we have this ball of light, and I, of course, I have to think of my mom's experience with her ball of light, that was under intelligent control. He's watching this when suddenly, he said, it became unnaturally quiet around them. You couldn't hear crickets. You couldn't hear anything. When he saw, straight out of a science fiction movie, he said, was this disc that was chromed. No surface features, no windows, just a perfect disc with a little cupola on top, like a flying saucer, a classic flying saucer. And he watched this thing it was in the distance, and it shot past him. He was flying maybe 5 feet off of the ground. After he watched that, he had no memory of anything else, but he and his wife, it was 8 o'clock in the morning the next day, that they both were, it's like they came to. They were leaning up against the bumper in the back of their station wagon. They weren't talking to each other. It was almost as if they had had this pact that they weren't going to talk about what just happened. They got back in the car. The children were still in the car, and then there's a newborn baby, and the baby, the baby's not crying. They were happy as could be, asleep in the back of the station wagon. 8 in the morning, so he drove. They got in the car and drove the rest of the way to his wife's sister's house. And it wasn't until they were leaving that he started talking about it with his wife, and she was very, very disturbed about it. She didn't want to talk about it. She felt like it was the devil, some horrible. I went into this case, and I just studied it from every angle. I got the interviews with the different family members and such, and dad's been talking about this for many, many years, and as long as I can remember. It was a very, very, just I had like 40, 50 pages of notes by the time I closed this case. I closed it as an unknown, a true unknown. I sent the case to Kathleen Martin. I guess that's the first time that I had, contact with Kathy at MUFON.
More UFO talk with MUFON's Earl Gray Anderson coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, alien, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
Welcome to Strange Harbor, and we talk about the weird. Our guest today from MUFON in California, Earl Gray Anderson, and we've been talking about his experiences working in MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network.
What do you recommend to those people who have had an alien abduction, loss of time, or revealing dreams of being visited by aliens?
These encounters kind of run the gamut. For some people, you know, it's all benevolent. And sometimes they'll mention the same stuff that the people that are horrified by it mention. You know, they'll have medical experience, you know, medical experiments done, that their DNA can be taken. Usually people are paralyzed. You know, their room or their vehicle or wherever they are will flood with light first, and then they become paralyzed, and that's when beings will walk through the wall. Or I mean, I had a police officer recently who was on duty and had an experience in his cruiser. Saw this ball of light outside. It was floating over his car, and the cab of his police cruiser flooded with light. And the next thing he knows, it's like a half an hour later. He had missing time, but he had a download. He suddenly understood esoteric mathematics, and he was a D student in math. But he felt like he had a download. And this happens to people, you know. It could be anybody. It could be you, me, a police officer, or oil field worker, scientist. The phenomena is no respecter of persons. It isn't random. We're being communicated with. And it's nothing new. My mom knew Wernher von Braun. That was one of the people that she talked about by name. She talked about him. She said, well, he used to call me Betty Grace. He's a very charming man. I was like, well, Mom, wasn't he a Nazi? It's like, no. Said, actually, he was not a Nazi. He was forced to work for that regime, but he was only interested in going to the moon and getting humans into outer space. She said that he had told her that we made the rockets right, but we sent them to the wrong planet. But he said in a few different interviews that the knowledge that we got to go to the moon, it was not homegrown, that people had downloads, that they had been given very distinct ideas, and that he believed that it was extraterrestrial in nature.
Where's the national threat come in? I mean, if they're downloading info to us and, you know, everything's kumbaya, why do some think that there's a problem here?
Because with any kind of technological advancement, it does wind up having a national security issue to it. And you have to figure, well, if we're getting downloads, people in China are probably getting downloads.
Yeah.
This is one thing. There's a paper that Kathleen Martin recently released that she has had communication with this one admiral. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But in the, you know, it talked about how what was happening here with UFOs and face-to-face meetings with entities, that it's happening in other governments, and that it doesn't seem like they aren't trying to help one government over another. So, of course, there's a scramble to keep things under wraps. That's why you've had the secrecy around the phenomenon all these years. And of course, it becomes a national security risk. I mean, I think that's what put, I mean, unfortunately, we do need to have an army. We do need an Air Force. And they're paid to be paranoid. They're paid to look at what could be a risk. They're doing their job when they do that, actually.
Do you believe that there are different kinds of aliens, and some may be benevolent and some may not?
I think that people will ask what the alien agenda is, and I think that there's different agendas. I think that there's different motives even within the same race of entities. You know, I'll have people that will see, you know, have an encounter with a tall grays that's just benevolent, and they're it's almost like this philosophical thing that they get, and then, you know, for another person it'll be a horror story. I mean, I have this one Marine who was taken from his barracks. And they told him that they were going to take his soul away from him. And there's another case where I spoke with all the family members and people that have known him forever. You know, I'd seen his discharge papers. He was exactly who he said he was. And for him, it was just a complete and utter horror. I know another guy who, a German gentleman out here, who wasn't even a MUFON case, who just somebody that came out to our meetings and he wanted to tell me his story. Well, he had an implant that was put into his foot after an encounter, and he'd had it surgically removed three different times, and they kept coming back and putting the thing back in. And he his whole attitude was, if I could grab them, I would throttle them, I'd kill them.
Well, there have been people that have done that, that were taken. They've actually
they killed the alien.
Stories like that.
There's stories of that.
I don't think it's a good idea to shoot your aliens because you might start an interstellar
right.
But I think that there's different races. It's like my mom said after seeing Star Wars. She said, that all the different races. And she said that distinctly. That's the way it really was. And so I believe that's true. Just plus all the people and all the stories I've heard from, a lot of aerospace engineers, a lot of scientists. We're not talking a bunch of hillbillies here. They're highly educated people that have face-to-face contact with these beings.
Why do aliens continue to abduct human beings? I mean, they already know our anatomy. They know everything about us. What's the second stage? What's the third stage? What do they want?
I'm not sure. There are different motives. Some people, we've all heard that, there's a DNA farming thing that's going on. Some say that the tall grays, that they messed with their own DNA to the point where they can't even reproduce. They have to clone, and that they need healthy materials, and apparently our DNA is compatible with theirs. There may be, panspermia may be a real thing, and there may be a root race that we all kind of come from. And,
I believe
and
that.
I do too. I mean, panspermia, it seems like that's the one logical theory that kind of explains why you've got bipedal creatures that, they don't all look like humans, but they have a humanoid shape, whether we're talking, reptilian aliens or the grays or Nordics.
We should probably define panspermia for our audience.
Sure. Well, the idea is that in the cometary halo, they call it the Oort cloud that surrounds our solar system. It's like this ring of snowballs that's around the solar system. We know this is true, that sometimes parts will break off, and that's what a comet is. And some believe that a comet hit Earth way back prehistory. While it caused the death of the dinosaurs, it also brought DNA, which led to humanity rising up, and it kind of bolstered. We're talking mammals suddenly became it took time, but that's the origin of humanity. And that the same thing happens throughout the universe, that there's a cometary cloud around other solar systems, star systems out there.
Right.
So that this is the thread that of commonality that we have with other bipedal entities of intelligence. And that's the idea of panspermia, that it's not life rising up randomly, but that there's a seed of life, that the universe. And some people think that perhaps this was done purposefully by high intelligence,
right.
God, or who, whatever you want to put the name to, that there was a motive behind this, to see the universe with, like Johnny Appleseed of the stars, with intelligence.
Right. There are people that believe that since we have definitive proof that Mars had some kind of life on it, and may still, that part of Mars, since we're finding Mars rocks on Earth, that was part of the panspermia project.
Yeah.
That they are looking at.
That one strange meteor that they found in, I guess it was Antarctica. This is back in the 1990s, late 1990s, I think, but it has what looks very, very much like, worms inside of this rock. And it's a Mars. It was a meteor that came from Mars. you know, it was that distinct red color and the oxidized iron.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And now, you know, they're finding the, I mean, of course, Mars still has a bit of an atmosphere. They're finding water on the planet, they believe, and these are the things of life.
And then they've recently found an FM radio signal coming from one of the moons of Jupiter.
How about that?
That was just recently
Arthur
released.
C. Clarke, his wonderful novel 2001 that he co-wrote with Stanley Kubrick. It was my favorite film since I was 10 years old. And I forced my parents to take me to see 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
For my 10th birthday. You know, I mean, I had this inherent, you know, this, just this interest in intelligent life ever since I was a baby, you know. But that's, it's every time we turn around, it seems like Arthur Clarke's ideas are real for some reason.
Yeah.
You know? So whether it's the monolith that they kept finding, like the yard gnome, you know, everywhere, or the, you know, and then Oumuamua, the asteroid that was shaped like a spindle. They wanted to call it Rama originally after one of, you know, Arthur Clarke's books, the novel called Rendezvous with Rama, where this object comes from out of our solar system, spindle-shaped. They send a team to it trying to figure out, they think that they must be interested in humanity, and it winds up going right past Earth, goes to the sun, sticks a big straw into the sun and sucks up solar plasma and then shoots off again. It's like, no, we don't care about you guys.
You're small stuff. there is a very high-ranking individual who believes that is an alien craft.
Yeah.
So,
it's from Harvard, I believe.
That's right. That's right.
The astrophysicist. Mm-hmm. He was not, you know, Shirley MacLaine. This guy knows his stuff. And it's nice when that happens, isn't it? It's like when John Mack, you know, bless him, and boy, we sure wish that he was with us still, but, you know, where he went and began the study into alien encounters, but as a scientist, as a physicist, and he certainly got ridicule, and they tried to censor him, but it's nice when we have, you know, a PhDs, you know.
That step up.
Step up, yeah. And some people, you know, I mean, even Carl Sagan, apparently his first paper that he had written professionally was about the ancient alien theory. He was kind of tamped down with it, and I think that, you know, most likely what happened was, it's like, well, we will fund you, we will give you funding, but you can't talk about this subject. So he started talking about aliens as if it was not a known, that it, you know, it's an unknown.
Right.
And he was very successful. Of course, Cosmos, you know, brilliant show.
Oh, that was on my coffee table for years.
He wrote a
wonderful
novel. It was about alien contact. But apparently he knew things, but they didn't want him to talk about it. So they gave him JPL and quieted him.
Yeah, that's absolutely certain. So here again, what should someone do if an alien craft lands right near them? What if aliens come out of the ship? Should they run away? What do you suggest?
I don't think you should run towards a UFO like Travis Walton did. He you know, didn't have a very good experience when he did that. And Travis thinks that he actually may have killed himself when he ran into this, you know, the propulsion field of this craft. And the reason why they abducted him was to fix him.
I know.
So you shouldn't run towards a UFO. But if a UFO lands next to you, I would be very cautious. Usually people don't have much of a choice. They're either paralyzed when this happens or, you know, I mean, there's that one story where a guy comes up to the UFO and they have like a little hibachi oven. They're making pancakes. He asked him for water. And so he went in the house. He got a little pan full of water and they made pancakes and fed him. These stories are crazy. It seems like some of the best UFO stories, there's always a thread of absurdity that runs through them, you know. And I don't know if it's the universe winking at us or nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know.
Well, maybe the aliens are finding their sense of humor now. Maybe we are rubbing off on them.
Maybe.
Where they're finding their humanity.
That could very well be a fact. I think that when we laugh, it starts out as a war cry. And then we look back at ourselves. We have the ability of laughing at ourselves. That we're all the same, that we all make stupid decisions. And so it's a failed war cry. It's the war cry that turns into a laugh. And it may be what the only thing that saved us from ourselves, the only thing that stopped us from, you know, sending the missiles off to another country, is our ability to see that we're all the same. So maybe the aliens have found their sense of humor through us. They seem to be perplexed by laughter, by music. There are certain things that are just that seem to be just very human things that may originate with us specifically. And it's very interesting. John Lennon saw a UFO. My old dear friend Chris Squire from the band Yes, it's a long story, but he was a close dear friend of mine. He saw a UFO that was exactly like the one that John Lennon saw, like a year later, a silver cupola disc with purple light spinning around the edge. So I don't know, maybe they're looking at, maybe they're music fans, maybe, you know, maybe they're interested in specifically people like John Lennon, Chris Squire, and it seems like a lot of musicians have had alien contact. John Anderson from Yes, he had aliens walk through his wall, and while he was paralyzed. I mean, so it seems like they're interested in our music, they're interested in laughter. There are certain things that are perplexing to them about humanity. So I've certainly thought about this a bit.
If they're all, you know, fine and dandy and happy-go-lucky, how come they got to paralyze us to do stuff? Why can't they just say, hey, you mind peeing in this cup for us? It'd be really cool. you know what I mean?
Sometimes people do get... I have one friend. I don't know if he wants to go public with a story, but he's another MUFON field investigator from another state. And he had an encounter... And he was hypnotically regressed, and they never paralyzed him. He was standing around. They were mantis creatures, and they spoke with him telepathically. And they wanted to know, because he and a little group, they were trying the CE5 thing, where you draw a UFO in telepathically. And they wanted to know more about our abilities and why certain humans were able to communicate mind to mind and others weren't able to do this. And they never paralyzed this friend of mine. He was able to stand there. He pushed way up against the wall of the craft because he was scared, because he kept thinking about, well, I've seen, you know, what a praying mantis can do, you know, to other insects. I don't want to wind up like that.
Yeah, you don't want to lose your head.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, again, I mean, the phenomena, it seems to run the gamut. I don't think that there's any one particular overriding motive. There seems to be different motives.
It's curiosity.
They're curious about us.
Yeah.
And if we have, say, a lion reserve, where it's a protected species, we'll go in there, we'll tranquilize them. We'll do medical experiments, we'll tag them, and then we'll leave them again in their natural environment. We it's not so much that we're hiding from them, that we want them to forget that we're there, so we can observe their behavior.
Right, right.
And so we can kind of internalize that and think about that as far as us being paralyzed, being tracked, and things like that.
That makes great sense.
Right. It's a big zoo here.
Yeah, I kind of am a zoo theorist.
Well, of course you would be. I just want them to be far more open. I would like to have the aliens. They're waiting for us to ascend. I don't know how long we have to wait. I mean, I've been working hard on my vibration, on my om. I'm working hard to be a really good person.
They want us to evolve.
Yeah.
That seems to be something a lot of people hear. They're disturbed by our warlike ways. They obviously don't care for our nukes very much, you know. Talked to Robert Salas about that.
Mm.
You know, they hovered over his old missile silo back in the 1966, and they took every single missile, you know, with thermonuclear capacity. You know, they had payloads. They took them all offline. You watched them. It's like blip, 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 blip.
My dad was all the there. One that was sent to fix them in Ohio.
This is in Montana. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The ones in Ohio. Yeah. My dad's the one that had to go and fix them one summer. I was with him. I think it was 1966.
Well, there you go. Well, you think that we're being told something?
Yeah. I think we're being told we're naughty children.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, I mean, we aren't quite intelligent yet. That seems to be a meme that I hear a lot from experiencers.
And now science says we're getting dumber.
And they want us to, you know, and Dr. Medich was asking the whole team, he said, keep hearing this over and over again. How do I vibrate at a higher level? I don't get it, you know. It's like they tell us what they want, but they don't tell us how we can do it.
Well, you get a higher vibration. You get a higher vibration by the deeds that you do and how you relate to other human beings, that we're all one. There's definitely a roadmap to this. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on our show. We're basically out of time, and you have been absolutely wonderful. I hope you're willing to come back.
Sure. Anytime, Cherie. I love talking with you guys.
How could we, like, reach out to you? Let's say a listener feels really comfortable and maybe wants to share an experience with you. Or
I communicate on Facebook with people. It's just look for Earl Gray. Usually I'll have some of my own digital artwork there. Well, you know, of a flying saucer or something to make it easy for people to know who I am. But you can message me even if you don't want to friend me, you know. So that's one way. Or you can always go to, I mean, MUFON.com is our main website. Locally here in Los Angeles, we have a website, MUFONLosAngeles.com. Put in your information. You could always email us there and just ask to speak with me. If you go to MUFON.com, there is a phone number for the California office, and they can also put you in contact with me. Yeah.
Thanks for talking with us today, and we'll keep in touch, okay?
Thank you, Johnny. It's my absolute pleasure. You guys have a wonderful week, and stay safe and well, and we'll talk to you some other time.
Before we wrap up the show, we have to give away our Strange Harbor dog tag.
Our winner is Chris Krista Richards.
Yay!
Krista, thank you so much for emailing us with such wonderful words. You made my whole day.
Do we want to give away another prize?
Let's give away another prize.
Okay, well, you're the prize gal. What are we giving away?
Oh, we're giving away the Strange Harbor hat.
All you have to do is go to strangeharbor.net, hit the contact, tell us what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show, and you'll be entered. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. Log on to strangeharbor.net, and you can win some fun prizes or share your experiences and all that stuff, or you can just yell at us for being tinfoil hat-wearing whack jobs.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.